Like it or not, our parents have an enormous impact on our adult lives. But that doesn't mean we're doomed to repeat their mistakes. Today on Truth for Life, Alistair Begg explains how God can redeem painful circumstances for good. Alistair is teaching from Genesis chapter 31. He begins today with a personal anecdote.
I can remember when we moved here, all the questions from my children. When are we going to go? How are we going to go? Will we drive there? No, we can't drive there. There's an ocean. Well, what will we do? Go on a boat? No, we'll go on a plane. And all the normal questions. Their tiny lives were just in an amazing whirl. And there was only one constant in it. And that was that their father said, this is it. This is what we're doing. Stick with me. You'll be okay. And for Joseph, the experience would have been exactly the same. You can imagine little Joseph saying to his mom, hey, mom, why did you take that stuff from Grandpa's house before we left? What stuff, Joseph? Well, those things he had in that corner cupboard. Why did you take Grandpa's stuff? I'll be quiet, Joseph. Don't worry about it. You know, your Grandpa knows me, and I know your Grandpa, and just run along, and you just go and play with the sheep. Hey, Dad. Why are we running away? Don't you like Grandpa? Doesn't Grandpa love us? Why do we have to go away under cover of darkness like this? Hey, Mom! How come Grandpa showed up? How come Grandpa and all the gang are camping over here beside us? Do you think he was on the fringe listening when his Grandpa looked at his dad and said, what have you done? You've deceived me? And you've carried off my daughters like captives in war. Joseph would have been saying to himself, that's right. That's what I said. I said, why are we running away? And now Grandpa came and said, that's exactly what we're doing. Why did you run off secretly and deceive me? Why didn't you tell me so that I could send you away with a party? And do you think that that wee boy did not process the question in verse 28? You didn't even let me kiss my grandchildren and my daughters goodbye. You've done a foolish thing. He was going to have a lot of tearing in his life. He was going to have a lot of times when he didn't get to say goodbye. He was going to have to learn how to weep, learn how to deal with the pain, learn how to deal with having his insides ripped out of him. And even in these early circumstances, God was forming and framing his tiny life in preparation for what would be. Oh, this is a wonderful, wonderful story. Do you think his eyes narrowed when he heard the question in verse 30? Now you have gone off because you longed to return to your father's house, but why did you steal my gods? And Jacob answered Laban, I was afraid. I thought you'd take your daughters away by force. But if you find anyone who has your gods, he shall not live. In the presence of our relatives, see for yourself whether there's anything of yours here with me. And if so, take it. Now Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen the gods. You see, when you're a deceiver, you'll make the people around you deceitful. As a husband becomes like his wife, so a wife becomes like her husband. And that's why our character in going into marriage is so very important. And you can only but imagine, as Joseph heard his mother from the top of her camel, as she sat on the saddlebags that held the gods for which her dad was looking. And she sinned her soul not only by stealing them, not only by being deceitful enough to sit on them, but she went the extra mile and opened her mouth and lied through her teeth, even when she probably didn't have to. Deceit will always do that. One deceitful action sends into process a cycle that is almost unstoppable. Listen to her from on top of the camel. Verse 35, she said to her father, don't be angry, my lord, that I cannot stand up in your presence. I'm having my period. So he searched, but could not find the household gods. And then if you'll turn to the end of the chapter, what a wealth of material is tied up in the concluding verse of chapter 31. They make a covenant with one another. They establish the lines of demarcation. They offer sacrifices together. They sit down and they have a meal. At the end of verse 54, and after they had eaten, they spent the night there. Those of you who have moved any vast distance know this experience well. It's etched indelibly in your memory forever. You'll never quite shake what it was like. All the anticipation of the evening, all the gathering of the family, all the union and the reunion and all the joy that was there, except for the fact that there was a cloud which descended over the event. And the cloud was the prospect of the morning. Because when the morning dawned, the party was over and the separation was inevitable. So you couldn't have all the joy of the evening union without the prospect of the morning party. And there in verse 55 is a painting. Early the next morning, Laban kissed his grandchildren and his daughters, and he blessed them, and then he left and went home. And what does a small boy make of all that? And in that, all things were working together for good for this young lad who was called of God according to his purpose. When Herod trembled, Jerusalem trembled. That's what the record tells us. The arrival of the wise men brought this question reverberating to the core of Herod's being. Where is he that is born King of the Jews? For we've seen his star in the east, and we've come to worship him. And Herod was troubled, and all of Jerusalem with him. In other words, when he started to freak out, the whole place freaked out. And so I am absolutely without question that the fear and distress which gripped the life of Jacob in the prospect of facing his brother in chapter 32 reverberated through the whole family. Verse 7 of 32, in great fear and distress, Jacob divided the people who were with him into two groups. And again, Joseph would have been in on this. He would have heard some of this stuff. And I wager that Joseph knew that there was something up with his dad. As the news of the 400 men, he just kept a little bit of it in his mind. There's 400 men coming with my uncle Esau. Why is he sending 400 men? Why is my dad so upset? And the reverberations of fear and distrust, you see, would work their way down through the family. And the hushed conversations would fuel the young man's expectations. What do you think that he made of the night when his dad left them alone, Genesis 32, 22. When Jacob gets up and takes his wives in the night and his two maidservants and his 11 sons and he crosses the ford of the Jabbok in the night, they have torches. Very few, because they want to do it circumspectly. And they're waking the children from their beds and they're saying, come on now, we're going across the river. And the kids are saying, why do we have to go in the middle of the night, for goodness sake? And the smaller ones are saying, what? I don't understand what's going on. And the father saying, look, just be quiet. Just do what your mother tells you. We're out of here. And so he ushers them all across the ford of the Jabbok. And verse 23, and after he sent them across the stream, he sends over all his possessions. And Jacob was left alone. Now, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but I know for sure that if I were to go through this, there would only be one question in my mind. Why is Dad not with us? Why did we go through all of this? Get us over here. What's he doing? What's Dad doing? And the fact of the matter was that Dad was meeting with God. Dad didn't even know that he was about to meet with God. God was going to come, as it were, and wrestle him to the ground and say, hey, chiseler, I want to give you a new name. Hey, deceitful, I want to turn your life around. Hey, I want to make you a brand new dad. I want to make you a whole new husband. And in the morning when he returned with his staff, which had become a characteristic of his life, now he leans upon his staff and he limps as he comes back into the family. Where do we get a limp all of a sudden? Do you think Jacob told him? I don't know, but I don't think so. Because Jacob is circuitous all the time. He confronts very little. He says very little, as we'll see. Did he use it as an opportunity to stamp in Joseph's tiny life and into his young memory the sinews of faith? It certainly impelled him in some way, because in chapter 33, when they get to Shechem, he sets up an altar. And as he sets up an altar, he sets his family apart from the surrounding culture. He distinguishes them. It's almost as though the experience of 32 starts to move him on. And then we have this dreadful experience in 34, the violation of the one daughter's purity. You think you could have 11 sons and one daughter and the 11 sons wouldn't look out for the girl? There's not a chance. Sure they did. Even if 9 of them took the day off, there were still 2 left to look after her. Do you think they noticed when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, saw her? Do you think that they cared when he saw him walk away with her? Do you think their hearts didn't burn with the deepest of passion when he had his way with her? And what of this boy, 10 or 11 years old, hardly cognizant of how the human reproductive system really works, and all of this hushed conversation and this mass aggravation on the part of his elder brothers, something to do with Dinah and what some fellow did to Dinah? And as he looks away to his father Jacob and hears Jacob saying, "Now let's be careful here. We don't want to become a disgrace to the surrounding culture." And the brothers looking at one another and say, "How can you be a father and think like this?" And so they take matters into their own hands. They set up this amazingly deceitful scheme. They get these guys in the most compromised of physical positions, and then they drive in under cover of darkness, and they butcher the whole place, and they bring in the outsiders, and they plunder the whole of Shechem. And in it all, God is working to form the character of this lad called Joseph. And so to Bethel, chapter 35, Jacob had been there before. He had been there, remember the ladder in 28, when he was fleeing from Esau. He says to the people, "Purify yourselves." He says, "Let's make sure that we experience God's presence before we go on from here." And then in the record, we have the story of bereavement into the home of Jacob. I don't have time to go through it all. Do it as your homework. You'll find the funeral of Deborah. And then the tragic loss of his wife, Rachel, for whom he'd worked for 14 years. All the expectation on Joseph's part of having a wee brother. By this time, he's 12. He's the closest of all the kids to what it will mean to have a little one. Those who are up in their late teens and early 20s, it's really so far gone. They could be the father of the child. There's really only one with a prospect of companionship, and that's Joseph. "Mom, when are you going to have the baby? Mom, do you think he'll be a brother? Will it be a sister? What'll happen?" And then finally, the day that mingles joy and sorrow. As the time of her delivery comes, and as she goes into the pangs and pains of childbirth, and as the contractions increase, and as the sense of terror grips her, and finally, as in giving birth, her very life ebbs out from her, and again in the life of this boy, tragedy and the dark threads of pain and sorrow and bereavement come crashing into his life and into his experience. God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea, and he rides upon the storm. And then the record of the death of his grandfather, and another burial service. And in the midst of all of that, the unthinkable. Verse 22. Following the death of this most treasured of his earthly companions, Rachel, while Israel, i.e. Jacob, was living in that region, his oldest boy went in and slept with his father's concubine, Bilhah. And all we're told is he heard of it. No action. How callous can a person be? Your father has just lost the wife of his devotion, the lady with whom you now are amorously involved, is in all matters of technicality and emotional relationship your father's wife. And in the very breath of the death of Rachel, you're involved in incestuous activity. When we get to chapter 49, we'll realize that Jacob had not forgotten about it, but until then we have to leave it aside. Chapter 36, the lineage of Esau. And chapter 37, verse 2, we're now back at the beginning of our sermon. Face to face, looking into the eyes of a young boy, age 17, who has been through more than most in the course of his formative years. Now, I have deliberately taken all of this time to give you a flavor of the background, and I commend you to further study. And I want you to notice that if you think you came from a dysfunctional background, you got a long way to go. And indeed, we all came from a dysfunctional background. Sin makes an individual dysfunctional. I don't even need anyone else in the room to be dysfunctional. But when you take my sin plus your sin and a few other people's sins, then we will all reveal the implications of the fact that we are out of alignment and therefore our wheels turn in different directions. Let me summarize it with just a number of thoughts. In the rough and tumble of a less than perfect family life, God was preparing Joseph for the role he'd planned for him. If ever there was a young boy who by the age of 17 had enough basis for blaming everything on his past, it was Joseph. But he didn't do it. He somehow realized that more spiritual progress is made through failure and tears than through success and laughter. He realized that God's grace was greater than all the daunting complexities of his early life. And the only explanation for the existence of Joseph and the role that he played is found in the electing grace of God. There is no human reason whatsoever as to why it should be that Joseph could ever emerge from this carnage, except that God purposed that it would be so. So, loved ones, I want to say to you, don't allow a bunch of books to try and explain your life for you in terms of the chiseling and channels and chains of your past to excuse you from your own activities or to legitimize your own impoverishments of mind and spirit. Listen, God is greater than all of that. And he brings beauty out of ashes. He gives the oil of joy for mourning. He gives the garment of praise for a spirit of heaviness. And our trials, as Augustine said, come to prove us and to improve us. One final thought. Here in these formative 17 years, there is a striking reminder of the impact that a father's life will have upon a boy or a girl. Jacob was not a good illustration of integrity. He was poor when it came to decisiveness. He was slow when it came to action. He was the master of passivity. He sat when he should have stood, and he stood when he should have sat. He was not a perfect dad. But God chose to use that imperfect dad to be the dad to the boy that he had purposed to be his redeemer of his people in the experience of Egypt. And indeed, one of the most moving scenes for which I can hardly wait is when Joseph gets to his dad in his old age and he just absolutely smothers him. I mean, the scene is pregnant with emotion when they're finally reunited. But there's no recrimination on Joseph's part. There's no recrimination with his brothers. His brothers say, you know, we're sorry we put you in the pit. We're sorry. He says, hey, listen, shh. God sent me here. No, no, Joseph, you don't understand. Hang on, hang on, hang on. No. You don't understand. God is sovereign in these things. And Dad, I know you're not perfect. But Dad, you're my dad. And I love you, man. I love you. Some of you kids, back off your old man. Some of you dads, quit putting your head in the noose that comes by the latest book that arrives on your shelf, telling you that unless you have got this right, that right, this right, and everything right, you will have nothing but garbage and carnage all your life. Don't believe it. Go for the gold. Do your best. Trust God. And at the end of the day, He will honor His name. He will vindicate your faithfulness. And although you haven't been perfect, out of the chaos and rubble of the background, He will raise that as a standard for His glory.
You're listening to Truth for Life with Alistair Begg and a message titled Family Ties. As we're going to see throughout this entire study, Joseph's life was far from easy. He faced trials and temptations, personal tragedies and family betrayals. But through it all, he continued to trust in God's sovereign plan, and God directed his steps and used him in mighty ways. Maybe you're facing a trial today, like the loss of a loved one or a painful disability. Maybe, like Joseph, there's conflict in your family, and you find yourself struggling to see how God could possibly use these circumstances for good. If that's the case, our team recommends a new book titled God's Grace in Your Suffering. Our initial reaction to suffering is often to ask the why question. Why me? Why this? Why right now? But David Pollison reminds us that God's plan rarely goes according to human understanding. And yet, even when we can't understand our circumstances, God's sovereign hand is always moving and guiding, always working things to make us more like Jesus. We'll send you a copy of this book today when you donate to support this ministry. It comes to you as an expression of thanks from fellow listeners. Request the book God's Grace in Your Suffering when you donate today by calling 888-588-7884, or it might be easier to give and request the book online at truthforlife.org. Now, before we conclude, here's Alistair.
Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust Him for His grace. Behind a frowning providence, He hides a smiling face. God grant to us the grace to trust You with the peculiar set of inconsistencies which are our lives. The events that grieve us, the milestones that encourage us, the chapters that pain us. May we, as it were, slip our hands into the hand of Joseph here and learn again to take You at Your word. May the grace of the Lord Jesus and the love of God our Father and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit rest upon and remain with each one of us today and forevermore. Amen.
I'm Bob Lapine for Alistair Begg and all of us at Truth for Life, hoping you will worship with your church family this weekend, and then join us again Monday as we continue our series called The Hand of God, Volume 1. Today's program was furnished by Truth for Life, where the learning is for living.